Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Lisa Hawkins, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Nobel Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is Nonviolent Struggle, Past Use, and Future Potential. And I'd like to introduce Rachel Carter, who will introduce our speaker. Rachel Carter is a community organizer for Peaceful Uprising, a local climate justice group. Please join me in welcoming Rachel.
Thank you. Today's speaker, Jamila Rakib, currently serves as the executive director of the Albert Einstein Institution in Boston, Massachusetts. She works closely with the scholar Gene Sharp, focusing on the study and promotion of strategic nonviolent struggle in conflicts worldwide. Jamila joined the Albert Einstein Institution in 2002 and is responsible for facilitating access to writings and other material on nonviolent struggle and supervising their translation into various languages. She has helped develop the key terminology for the field in numerous languages. Her current responsibilities include responding to requests for information from individuals and groups around the world, providing editorial assistance to Dr. Sharp, coordinating publication agreements with international publishers, and speaking with journalists about strategic nonviolent struggle and the work of the Albert Einstein Institution. She has also lectured extensively on the topic and has represented the institution at numerous domestic and international events on a host of issues related to its programs, research, writings, and educational work. Jamila was born in Afghanistan, and her native language is Pashto. She is a research affiliate at the Center of International Studies at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. So with no further delay, here's Jamila.
Thank you very much for that introduction. It's an honor to be with you all, and I appreciate the warm welcome here. I actually just returned from Afghanistan last week, and I was feeling a little nostalgic for the mountains, so, you know, I guess I came to the right place. I'd like to start today by telling you a little bit about the organization that I work for and the work that I do. So I work at the Albert Einstein Institution in Boston with Gene Sharp, the world's foremost scholar on the topic of nonviolent struggle, which is also sometimes referred to as civil resistance or people power. Gene Sharp has written for decades on the technique of nonviolent struggle, what it is, how it works, and how it can be used by groups struggling for a variety of social and political objectives. So in 1983, he founded the Albert Einstein Institution in order to study the dynamics and the potential of nonviolent action and to promote its use in place of both violence and passivity in conflicts around the world. So this year marks the 30th anniversary of the Einstein Institution, and in those 30 years, I'm proud to say that we played a major role in advancing the worldwide spread of these powerful ideas and these tools. So people who, you know, come to our office are often amazed, especially those who have their minds made up that we're a U.S.-funded organization and part of some sort of sinister plot to control the world. What they actually find is a really small office in a residential neighborhood filled with paper and boxes and books. The staff consists of myself, Gene Sharp, our colleagues Jessica and Michael, and Sally, our golden retriever. But from this office, we conduct some very important work. We make available the research and the writings that play a major role in aiding resistance movements around the world. At times, people visit our office from all over the world and in the country. And in addition to their surprise at the size of our office and the size of our staff, what they learn and they find is never what they expect. Some come looking for specific instructions on how they can wage a nonviolent struggle for their issues. But we're clear that we don't tell people what to do or give specific advice. What we do and what this approach does is give them a way of looking at their situations. We give historical examples of what other groups have done and the lessons that we have distilled from that history in order to provide guidance that can be useful for them. As someone once exclaimed to me as I walked them to their taxi, "I haven't learned anything new, but my head has been rearranged." So people leave our office, and their minds are now open to new possibilities. They learn that having a wise plan greatly increases effectiveness, and that thinking and studying is a prerequisite to developing that plan. They learn about the factors that increase their chances of success and those that can lead to defeat. They learn that they must study their situations, their strengths and weaknesses, and those of their opponent. They must also become experts in this technique, learn how and why it works when it succeeds, and learn why it fails when it does not. So I'm not going to spend too much time today talking about the fundamentals of this technique and how it operates. You can get that pretty easily from a lot of the publications we have on our website and on other websites. But nonviolent action is a means of struggle that serves as a viable alternative to violence and passivity for people struggling for social and political change. Nonviolent struggle is not inaction or passivity. Here's the basic idea. So governments, even extreme dictatorships, rely on cooperation and obedience from people and institutions for their existence. These sources of power are referred to as pillars of support. So when people and institutions choose to withdraw or withhold that cooperation and obedience, and they can maintain that resistance even in face of repression, governments are left without any of the necessary sources of power. It's a technique based on the social, political, and economic application of basic human stubbornness. It's the determination and the ability to dissent, to refuse to cooperate, to defy, and to disrupt. So in other words, people refuse to do the things that they're told to do, and they do that which they're forbidden to do. Nonviolent struggle has been applied in various types of conflicts throughout human history to resist oppression, undermine dictatorship, to oppose foreign occupations, to defend the rights of women, of workers, of minorities, and to expand freedoms of all kinds. Symbolic methods like parades, marches, and vigils, these are the most well-known forms of nonviolent struggle, and they're most often associated or sometimes even equated with nonviolent struggle. But while they can be important, they're actually considered mild methods compared to the methods of non-cooperation and intervention, which are more powerful for bringing about change. The methods of non-cooperation need to be applied to cut off the supply of sources of power and to paralyze the opponent. So what you're trying to do is to withdraw support to the point of disintegrating your opponent by producing political paralysis. So throughout history, these means have been used with great effectiveness in an improvised fashion, so often spontaneously with limited planning. Rarely we've seen great strategic geniuses like Gandhi, but relying on intuition can lead to defeat. The chances that a nonviolent struggle will be successful can be greatly increased by acting in accordance with a wise strategic plan. A wise plan requires careful thinking, so you identify the characteristics of the present situation, what needs to be done, why, when, how to do it, all while countering the opponent's actions and repression. Everyone here is probably aware of the nonviolent struggles that took place in Egypt and Tunisia, but nonviolent struggle has been and continues to be used in diverse cultures and societies around the world in very organized and creative ways. I'm amazed at the examples of human creativity and innovation that we are increasingly seeing. For example, let's look at the flamenco protest taking place in Spain to protest the austerity measures put in place by the Spanish government. So here's what I know about it, about how this works. Angry citizens walk into banks. They perform live flamenco shows, complete with songs and anti-bank lyrics, before disappearing as quickly as they've arrived or being forcibly removed by bank security. So as one commentator put it, "Marching outside in the cold with signs, shouting slogans, so 20th century." The group responsible is called Flow 6x8, so 6x8. They have a video tutorial posted on their website for the flamenco protesters with lyrics and music, which people can use, and then they tailor the protest to their individual styles. So, a quote from one of the members, "It's a form of civil disobedience. We go into a place where the powerful are, and we invert the order of things. We demand attention, and we say, here we are, using our bodies to fight the financial system." Now, we know that the performances, on their own at least, are not going to completely transform the Spanish banking system or solve every problem related to the current financial crisis. But what these protests have achieved is important. They've created an outlet for political expression. They've allowed people to express their discontent without resorting to violence. They've gotten the authorities' attention, and they've shown people that they're not powerless. So the idea that you take a culturally important symbol, in this case flamenco music, one that's traditionally and historically been linked with the expression of social and political realities, is clever. People recognize that co-opting and using these symbols conveys the seriousness of their grievances, it places their issues in a historical context, and it communicates the social and political economic values that they support, rather than just what they're protesting or what they're against. They're also creating what we call a dilemma action. By using an important cultural symbol, people are forcing their opponent, in this case the bank, to use police and security guards to expel them from their property, and to look foolish and unjust while doing so. In terms of the public perception of the action, it's certainly more effective than vandalism or violence. After one performance, the group received over 600,000 visitors to their website, so obviously people are responding to this. The availability of new technologies and social media has opened up new and exciting possibilities in terms of how people communicate, access information and tools, and broadcast their message to each other and to the outside world. These platforms are extremely important. People no longer need to rely on the mainstream media to broadcast information about their activities and their message and demands or whatever it is they wish to share with the world, which is why some governments fear these tools and are therefore controlling access to the internet and censoring specific social media tools. For example, during the Arab Spring, the Chinese government took great efforts in censoring information about the protests that were taking place in Egypt and Tunisia. So a recent study at Harvard reveals some extremely interesting information about paranoia among Chinese rulers that might surprise you. It surprised me. It isn't criticism from its citizens that the Chinese government fears most. In fact, the study found that there's relative freedom in expressing dissatisfaction with national or local policies or officials, whether on Twitter, on Facebook, or on your blog. It's actually any discussion of collective action that elicits the most severe reaction from government censors. So basically, you can express your anger at a corrupt official on your blog. You can tweet about how terrible some policy is. But the Chinese government doesn't really have a problem with Chinese citizens venting about them, but at least not until they propose to act together to protest or demand a change. So that should tell us something about how people should focus their activities, whether in China or in Salt Lake City. When we're a lone voice protesting on our own and expressing our grievances, we can be more easily dismissed and ignored because we're not much of a threat. But when we act together with others in an organized way, with thought and in accordance with a plan, we can begin to present a serious challenge to our opponents. That's also when we can expect a reaction from our opponents, one that's intended to make us abandon our activities. So again, preparation and planning is key in order to avoid that, a collapse in your movement. The internet and social media also aids in the process of reducing atomization within society. So atomization is the idea that each citizen is an isolated unit without the links and connections that make collective action possible. In other words, if you think you're the only person who's angry about a particular abuse or policy, you may feel powerless to do anything about it. Online technologies like Facebook and Twitter can show you you're not alone and can embolden you to take steps to change existing conditions. But, and this is a big one, these tools don't tell you what to do or replace the need for real study and planning. While new technologies can be utilized by social and political movements in incredibly beneficial ways, it's very important that we understand that these technologies are tools of communication and not strategies in and of themselves. So in Finland, a couple of years ago, a Facebook page called for a general strike, which is a really powerful method and one that you better be sure people are going to turn out for a general strike before you call for one. So maybe that was the first mistake. And the general strike was to protest a pay raise for Finnish parliamentarians. So in spite of the fact that their Facebook page got 110,000 likes, only a few protesters actually showed up for the demonstration outside the Finnish parliament, and the action failed. So I think there's at least two important lessons there. First, in the absence of wise strategic planning, reliance on social media to conduct your struggle is usually inadequate to achieve certainly long and even sometimes short-term objectives. Second, even as a component of a good strategy, expecting online organizing to automatically transform to real action and participation on the ground is unwise. In Tunisia and Egypt, the use of social media was wisely formulated to combine online organizing with offline planning and action, but not to replace it. So this was an important lesson that the organizers of the Egyptian and Tunisian revolutions learned from the failure of the Green Movement in Iran. The Iranian regime used internet surveillance methods to gather information on those involved in organizing street protests. So people using Facebook and Twitter to organize street protests were obviously monitored so they'd know who to arrest and imprison. Pretty simple. In Egypt, organizers wisely assumed police were monitoring their communications. So they sent them off to false protest locations that were announced on their Facebook sites. And simultaneously, members of their group were sent quietly into other neighborhoods, sort of less, in the center of the city, poor neighborhoods, to organize the groups that were later successful in taking over Tahrir Square. So though we usually refer to atomization when speaking about extreme dictatorships, it's important to remember that atomization of societies can occur under systems, other systems of government. So even in countries that are more democratic, people might think that they're powerless and that they're the only ones that hold particular views or grievances. Nonviolent struggle, because of how it operates, it actually depends on strengthening institutions, non-state institutions. This strengthens people's resistance capacity to deal with challenges going on today and also future ones. So in February of last year, the people of Keene, New Hampshire, were surprised in anger to learn that their city council had accepted a government grant to buy essentially a tank. It was an 8-ton Bearcat armored personnel vehicle for its police department, right? So we're talking about a town of 23,000 people and almost no crime. So this kind of thing, I was surprised to learn, has been happening a lot since 9/11. The Department of Homeland Security has been making grants to towns and cities to purchase military equipment. And the public and media response has been mostly silent or approval. But in Keene, that wasn't the case. So instead of going along with the deal, the people organized a series of actions. They circulated an anti-tank petition that received 500 signatures and flooded a city council meeting where they made their views known very clearly. So they questioned the need for the military vehicle in a town with almost no crime, even though it was free. You know, the town didn't have to pay for it. Someone obviously did. But and they expressed their concern about the militarization of their police department and the impact of that on their community. So essentially what happened was that the deal was put on hold. It was put to a vote and defeated. And last spring, it didn't pass. And then a few months later, when things quieted down, unfortunately, it did pass. And the town now has a tank to make it safe. So one way we can look at that action is to evaluate success based on the objectives of those who initiated it. So the efforts were aimed at preventing the purchase of the vehicle for the city, and eventually it failed to do that. However, it's important that we keep in mind a key point. People and movements learn from failures just as they learn from success. The action in Keene very likely had important consequences in terms of mobilizing people's efforts, building their confidence, and establishing networks that can be utilized as a basis of future action. Who knows? Having learned from their past defeat, the people of Keene may tackle the next issue more effectively and win. Even the most well-known historical movements and great successes that they have achieved have to be looked at in the context of a process. So part of the problem is that the media and television cameras usually only capture the dramatic stuff that happens towards the end, so in the streets, so the demonstrations and the public protests, and often only when they reach a point where they're deemed to be newsworthy. What they don't do and what they can't do as well is document what happens more quietly when no one's watching. And it's the planning and the thinking and the studying and the short-term defeats, the formulation of limited campaigns. It's the process. So which sometimes gives people the incorrect impression that nonviolent changes that we've seen in recent and past years were produced solely by the protests and demonstrations that we see on our television screens, or that the changes were produced quickly, or that the struggle was spontaneous. And therefore, if only they can flood the streets with enough people, the desired change will somehow simply materialize. Serge Popovic is one of the founders of the Serbian movement, Otpor. He says that the ouster of Milosevic, which captured the world's attention because of its dramatic display of people power, was the culmination of decades of work, of years of failures and limited successes, and of a lot of planning, and not just of a grand strategic plan, but of component campaigns that brought them closer to the spectacular events that we saw, or maybe some of you guys are too young, of October 2000. The good news is that developing strategies that have a chance of working is within our capacity, and that the tools to do it skillfully exist, that they're being improved and refined and innovated. This doesn't mean that conducting a struggle is simple, but as we all know, struggling for what is important very often isn't easy or without risk. In the 11 years that I've been working with Jean at the Einstein Institution, we've seen a massive shift in the recognition and attention to our work and in the spread of nonviolent struggle and these ideas around the world. People ask us all the time about whether we're surprised about this spread, that a tiny office with a small staff and a really small budget could be responsible for writings and ideas that go on to reach people in groups in nearly every country in the world and in places where there's war and conflict and oppression and even in places where there's relative stability and democracy. The truth is, we've been confident for many years that this would happen, that eventually there would be a breakthrough in recognition for these ideas. People facing difficult circumstances would begin to explore the potential of this technique and realize that social and political change can be achieved through nonviolent means, provided that they think carefully and plan wisely, act courageously, that the opponents that they view as all-powerful and invincible, that they have weaknesses, that the exploration of their opponents' weaknesses and their own strengths can illuminate their capacity to change their societies in ways that can have a massive impact on their lives, on their communities, and indeed the world. However, despite this breakthrough, there's still much work to be done. Nonviolent action is still not widely understood. The technique needs to be further developed and refined, just as we spend billions and billions of dollars to refining military warfare. This is also very sophisticated and complex and requires attention and research. However, the possibilities for the spread and development of this technique are limitless, and it is exciting to see where that takes us in the future. So that's all I have. I look forward to the discussion, and thank you all for being here today. Shall I stay
here?
Yeah.
Joe, are you okay taking a few questions?
Yeah, of course.
Sure.
Could you say a word about the film, How to Start a Revolution, that was released a little over a year ago? It has not aired very much at all in Salt Lake City, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
And I would hope that it would be picked up and used on campus and classes and so forth. And so far, it's been very quiet here regarding that film.
It has it. Okay. Yeah, it's amazing. Thanks for mentioning the film. So 3 years ago, before this big breakthrough, before the Arab Spring, we had a journalist come to or write to us at first and say he wanted to do a film. He was covering revolutions in different parts of the world, and he noticed that a lot of them were talking about the sort of common thread, that a lot of the strategy was informed by a book that by an author nobody had ever heard of, you know? And here's this sort of 80-plus-year-old man living in, like, a townhouse in Boston, and he thought it was a really great story. So he didn't know what to expect. In part, he thought maybe he'd find that we were CIA-funded, like people were alleging, and that, you know, he'd come and find some sort of slick corporate office. But what he found was what you see in the film, which is this sort of tiny office in this sort of rundown part of Boston. And as I said, that was 3 years ago, so it was before this was sort of a big news story. And the film ended up taking a really long time to film and to buy the archives and to release it, in part because the filmmaker was broke. He was sort of self-funding it so he could control the content of the film. And because he was broke and because it took so long, eventually the Arab Spring happened, and he was able to incorporate a lot of the stuff from Egypt and Syria, which I think made it a much better film. And eventually it was released in September of 2011. It premiered in Boston. We had no idea what to expect. We all saw it for the first time at the same time as everyone else. It's amazing the response that the film has received. We were I'm embarrassed to say, a little skeptical because we're, you know, heavily focused on academic writing and the books and all of that. And we thought, what exactly could a 90-minute film convey? But it turns out that what it's done is really inspire a lot of people to go out and read and to learn more and to learn about sort of what's possible and to really connect with the work, which has been amazing. So the film has gone on to win a lot of international prizes, and it's been pirated all over the world, which... I don't know how the distributor likes, you know, what I'm about to say, but I'm all for that. You know, it's great. I mean, they're not going to download from wherever. They're going to find it any way that they can. And it's become almost like a sort of cult film in different parts of the world, and it's being distributed in flash drives in countries where, obviously, it's banned. And so, anyway, sorry, does that answer your question? There's a lot to say. It's screening tomorrow. Here, and maybe you can tell me where it's screening.
Yeah, I can comment
sure.
as well. So tomorrow there will be a screening. There's a couple of different versions. The cinematic version runs 80-something minutes, and it will be screening in full tomorrow at 10 a.m. at Salt House, which is 741 South, 400 West. And then following that screening, Jamila, along with Peaceful Uprising, we're presenting a creative activism workshop that, you know, kind of combining some of the climate justice movement's work with the theories of Jean Sharp. And while I'm up here, I just want to make a couple of announcements about who we're sponsoring. This talk is part of the Pathways to Peace series. Sponsors include ourselves, Peaceful Uprising, the Tanner Human Rights Center, UVU Peace and Justice Studies Program, the School of Humanities and Social Sciences, Salt Lake Community College, Middle East Center, Religious Studies Program, the Marriott Library, Salt Lake Public Library, and the Gandhi Alliance for Peace, Utahns for a Just Peace in the Holy Land, and Wasatch Coalition for Peace and Justice. And so in addition to this audio being available on KUER, many of the recordings from previous talks are going to be available at www.humanrights.utah.edu. So sorry to interrupt with that little bit of info about the Pathways to Peace program. But yeah, tomorrow that screening along with a workshop afterwards.
Okay, well, what's the name of the book and what's the name of the film, first off, and then I've got a couple other questions.
Okay, so there's not just one book, right? Jean Sharp's publication list is the size of a publication. That's probably not that funny, but it's like an Einstein Institution joke. But his big book is called, or not big, it's only 100 pages. It's called From Dictatorship to Democracy, and that's sort of the... the book that's probably read most widely, is most popular. It was written for Burmese dissidents, so some Burmese groups asked him to write a book that could be helpful for them, and he said, well, I don't know Burma, but I know dictatorships. So he took a couple of years to produce this book that was written in 1993, and since then it's sort of like a handbook for revolutionaries around the world.
From what to democracy?
For dictatorship. Dictatorship to Democracy. So it's available for free download as a PDF from our website, and we have printed copies, and I even have a few printed copies here.
What's your website address?
I'm not very good at this. about one part of this I'm not very good at. It's aeinstein.org.
And the name of the film?
And the name of the film is How to Start a Revolution.
Just had a couple other questions,
sure.
Just kind of on your background. When did you come to the United States? What did you do before the Einstein Institute? And how did you get the job there?
Okay. I've been in the U.S. since I was a baby or quite young. Sorry, what was the rest of it? Not very good at personal questions. I was a student. I went to Simmons College, and I applied at the institution, and I got the job, and I've been doing that ever since. Yeah.
How long have you been doing the job?
11 years, yeah. So quite some time.
You said earlier that your nonviolent strategy is obviously aimed to give people an outlet so they don't turn to violence. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that doesn't always work, as Libya and Syria kind of show. What do you think kind of went wrong there? How do you think that the strategy didn't quite work out?
Mm-hmm. Right. So we think that people are only likely to use nonviolent means of struggle if they think it has a chance of working to achieve their objective. So people are not going to reject violence from a moral position, that, you know, that the availability of this knowledge is important. And so that's key for a lot of different places, sort of generally. In terms of Libya and Syria, it's really tough to say. I think part of it is that a wise plan that takes into account the possibility of a shift to violence is really important. And it's a question of whether they had that wise plan, you know, a plan that anticipated repression. You know, people think that if they use nonviolent means, that their opponent is going to react nonviolently also. And that's not the case. If you present a serious challenge to your government, like in Libya and in Syria, where those were very, very powerful movements, nonviolent movements at the start, you're going to be met with the maximum repression that your opponent thinks they can get away with. And so then to say, okay, violence was used, so now we have to shift to violence, and in my view, I can see how that happened, but I don't think it was wise, and I don't think you know that that's really valid. So planning for repression is really important, and it's a question of whether that happened. Shifting from very high-risk activities, high-risk being facing machine guns and the regime's troops every day, you know, like the way we saw in Syria, I mean, day after day, and the types of killings we saw, that's not sustainable. So how do you shift to methods that are powerful but less risky? And these are how do you undermine the military, not in the streets, but behind the scenes? And was it necessary for that day-to-day sort of high-risk activity? I'm not sure that it was. And I think it was understandable that that level of repression produced that shift that we saw that was not in the best interest of the movement, the people in charge of the initial movement, because now it's taken on a very different form, and people are really concerned about what kind of government are we going to see emerge from this extreme violence. I know a little bit less about Libya, but there were very high-level defections in the beginning, and in Syria and Libya both, and you know, so that's part of the problem. When military and police are defecting, there has to be a plan of how to incorporate them into the movement without them bringing their guns. And I think in some cases, that plan was not put into place. It's always going to be a challenge to make sure that the movement stays nonviolent. This is not taken for granted. But there's things that people can do, the planning process, that can take that into consideration. You're welcome.
You alluded a couple times to having encountered suspicions that you're connected to the Bush administration initially, right? And when one goes to your website, one sees responses to these things. And I wonder whether you want to flesh out that story a little bit, talk about the challenge of dealing, you know, advocating a principle and a method within these highly charged political conflicts, and therefore becoming sort of a suspicious person, agency in that situation. Talk about maybe how you've dealt with that a little bit. And I guess now, you know, with the presence of the film, probably a larger spotlight on your organization, has that become a bigger challenge to try to make clear what it is that you folks are doing and advocating?
Mm-hmm. I'll start with the second question first, which is what the film does is show how we operate, and we're, you know, I don't mean to keep emphasizing this, but this tiny office, you know, it's really just crowded with all of this stuff. And so if we were really sort of CIA funded, you would think they would be able to cough up a bit more than what they're not giving us. Make sure I'm not misunderstood. So I think what it has done is dispel a lot of the allegations. But, you know, some people are convinced of things, and no matter how much sort of evidence that you present them with, they're not going to change their minds because they've got a very set ideology. And our goal is not to convince everyone of everything. That's just not going to be possible. And I think that if the goal of some of these allegations is to disrupt our work, then I think responding to all of the attacks would be really effective in what they were setting out to do. So we've been, this is not new. Gene Sharp, since he's been doing this work, maybe not since the very beginning, but since it's been getting attention, he's had attacks of various kinds, right? So in Burma, for example, the dictatorship went on radio for like weeks and was denouncing him, you know, as a U.S. government spy or as trying to destabilize, you know, or if we were a weak dictatorship, if we were a weak and stupid government, this would have worked. You know, this is sort of what they were saying. And in one case, a newspaper was like, these are the methods that people shouldn't use, and then went on to explain them all in very great detail. So it's always a question of, you know, what's the motivation behind some of these attacks? And what they have done is actually bring more attention. So starting from the Burmese attacks, they've sort of progressed. Then we had, you know, various governments. So some of them are really sourced at government agencies. Mm-hmm. So governments are threatened by this work, and they promote this misinformation. And it's a question of whether they actually believe it or not, and I'm not sure. But clearly they know it's very effective, right, to say that we are linked with the CIA or, you know, that's where we get our funding, or that we're an organization that seeks to promote U.S. foreign policy. You know, people are going to become very suspicious of being associated with us because that carries risk in doing the type of activist work that many of these people are doing without sometimes contact with us, you know. So I think they recognize that it's effective. And then there's other types of attacks by people who, you know, people on the extreme left or people on the extreme right. I mean, they're really across the political spectrums, just so as, the, you know, the support is also very diverse from people who believe many different things. You know, we tend to ignore them. We did put the open letters there so that people, you know, could see our responses to them. And we tend to focus on our work because I think that's probably the best way to go about it. Our work is a generic analysis. It's not written for any particular country. And it's made available. We try to strengthen the tools. They can be used for a variety of objectives that we may not agree with, but we think that's very positive because it means we're reducing reliance on violence. And so, you know, to attack a generic tool and a technique as being for a particular ideology, I think it doesn't really make a lot of sense to me, but unfortunately some people do believe it.
Hello, my name is Satine. I'm a political science student, pre-med also. And my question for you, my uncle was almost taken by the police protesting in Iran in 2009. And it was a very interesting movement. And I was wondering if you had any comment exactly about what you think went wrong, because it seemed really, really strong. And the people of Iran kind of got around the government in very creative ways. Mm-hmm. My family would watch TV shows from Iran, and we'd notice that everybody in that TV show, their mm-hmm. headscarves, their ties, their braces would be green, or you would see mm-hmm. signs everywhere you looked in that country, and without aggravating the government to the extent where they would be squashed by mm-hmm. military police. Mm-hmm. What do you think exactly failed? Because it kind of went from being on CNN 24/7
yeah,
and
right.
it just died overnight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we get this question a lot. I probably don't have enough information to really answer it properly. There's Iran experts and Green Movement experts. My general impression is that, like in other movements, there's an excessive focus on symbolic methods of protest. These are protests and demonstrations. They're also the most risky in a repressive environment or society. So thinking that if only you stay out in the streets for long enough, the government will crumble, I think is probably not wise. And again, like in Syria, when met with massive repression, it can do a few things. So there's a process of what Gene in our writings called political jiu-jitsu, which is that the oppression of your opponent can backfire on them and draw more people into the movement. And you saw that happening in Iran. I mean, people saw the killing of Neda, you know, and that was sort of like internationally and probably domestically huge, you know, in really bringing a lot of clarity to the extreme repressive nature of the regime. So it can work in that way, right? But it can also work to really scare people and collapse, you know, cause a collapse in the movement. And so I think that possibly a more of a focus again on different types of non-cooperation, again, instead of, for example, you know, Gene always gives this example, instead of flooding the streets or calling for a demonstration in which we all come out and face, you know, the government, why not a stay-at-home strike where everyone stays at home and the streets are empty? And think about what message that sends to the regime. So I think that, you know, expressing dissatisfaction and protest, we always get into, or I've noticed that people historically have thought that, you know, expressing dissent is enough. So expressing dissatisfaction, all that really does is communicate that X number of people doing this action today are dissatisfied with the current policies, but doesn't do much to weaken the regime. And so what our work does is really talk about the very diverse methods that have been used historically, how they fit into a grand plan. And if you're not ready to take on the regime today, perhaps you might start with something smaller, a issue that has widespread popular support on which you can win. And maybe calling for the end of the regime, again, I don't know, that would be up to the Iranians to decide, was not feasible. It may have been desirable, but maybe it was just not practical at that point. So I don't think it was a failure necessarily, like I said about, you know, the Keene, New Hampshire, less serious issue. I think that we've got to look at these movements in the context of building up to something, and that perhaps the movement learned, and perhaps they're quietly studying, and perhaps next time they're going to win. So, you know, it's really hard to say. I just don't like to look at things as failures. You know, people always say, like, this movement failed or the Egyptian movement failed because we haven't got a perfect society there. And I think we tend not to look at things that way. Yeah. Hi.
Hi. My name is Jefferson. I'm a student here at the university as well.
Okay.
My question is an example of nonviolent protest, I guess, in the United States would be Occupy Wall Street. And two of the critiques of that are that they really lacked leadership and that they lacked definitive goals. So my question, I guess, is do you think that this is something that was avoidable in this case, and how do you prevent it in protests in the future?
Good question, and that's a tough one. I bet you could answer it better than I could. I think you just have clearer objectives, although I say this once in a while that Occupy movement didn't have clear objectives, and people say, well, you weren't listening. So maybe I don't know enough about what happened. Maybe they were not articulated as well because the general perception is that way. So I think, again, focusing on a smaller issue that has widespread popular support, building confidence so that you can move on to tackle the next thing, is probably a better way to have started out than saying, we're going to occupy a public space, we're going to stay here, you know, because then the strategy becomes about maintaining your presence on that space, which the cops are going to eventually remove you from. So I think that that's, again, focusing too heavily on symbolic methods and not doing enough analysis about strategy, about what it is you hope to achieve. Is it the end of the financial system? I mean, the economic system, the present economic system? Is it a major overhaul of that? Because that is quite a big task, and people have tried to do that since the beginning, for centuries. So I think, again, picking objectives on which you can win and being realistic about those would have been good. And I went to I wasn't involved in Occupy, but I was observing sort of from a distance, and I went to Occupy Boston, and I remember just this meeting going on, and I just observed from a distance, and they discussed for a really, really long time about strategy. And what they talked about was how do we use the little funding that they had raised to purchase blankets, which I was confident they could have gotten donated, you know, from the community. But instead, this was like their main point for the night. And maybe, you know, and I went back a couple of times, and always the discussions were on really sort of secondary issues. There wasn't a lot of strategic planning or even tactical planning. It was about how do we survive on this space? You know, because it's cold, and I don't know. It didn't seem to me practical, and it didn't seem something that was going to really draw the wider public. But this country is really angry about a lot of things. I mean, people are really angry. There has to be an issue on which you can actually mobilize ordinary Americans, and you know, it's up to you guys to find out what that is, and to launch a campaign based on that action rather than on we're really angry. We're going to make it known. Yeah.
Even with all of the so-called critique of Occupy Wall Street, not so much critique, but disappointment, I think Occupy Wall Street had an enormous impact on this absolutely. Country. I mean, it encouraged organizations to form. Mm-hmm. It encouraged groups to address specific issues. Yeah. It encouraged candidates to run for office. It had an enormous awareness, positive impact. And so rather than some people sort of saying it was very ineffective,
right?
What was ineffective was the public response mm-hmm. to what Occupy Wall Street accomplished. Because fundamentally, the great bulk of the people in this country are incredibly apathetic and uninvolved and even ignorant mm-hmm. of most of the issues. But now let me ask my question.
That's a very good point. So I did a lot of nodding, and I just want to make sure that the mic caught that I agreed.
What's the current sort of publication project that you folks are working on, and when can we expect another citation there in that list of productions from the Institute?
Yeah, we're actually in the process of printing a new book, which we've been working on for a while. It's called How Nonviolent Struggle Works. So it's pretty self-explanatory. It's a 100-page kind of treatment about nonviolent struggle. And how it operates and how it can work effectively against organized opponents, even in face of repression. So it dispels a lot of the common misconceptions that this works in a, you know, when your opponent is a gentleman or whatever. And it's short. It's really practical information. It's still theoretical stuff, but I think it's very readable. And I don't know, but I think it's as good as From Dictatorship. That's a tough one because people really love that book. But I think that Where From Dictatorship is about how this works against a authoritarian regime or a dictatorship. This is more general. It's something that I think we can use in our communities. And so I'm really excited about it. And it's at the copy editor. So it's probably just weeks away from printed copies, and probably even sooner we'll have it online for online dissemination. So yeah, that's the new one. You're welcome. Gene's also writing a book about Einstein's political views. So how his thinking evolved in response to different events in the world. Okay.
How would you rank peaceful uprisings' effectiveness in what they're doing? And also, how would you adapt, or what of these methods of yours would you use to get the public more behind responsible gun control legislation on the national level?
Mm-hmm. Two very good questions that I can't answer. Number one, peaceful uprising. I need to learn a bit more about what it is that you do, and in terms of effectiveness. So far, I'm impressed with the people I've met. I've just had lunch with a few of them, and I am impressed with their seriousness, their their understanding of this work about how the technique operates, and about how and the need and the recognition that maybe there's other capacities that they need to gain. So I was telling Rachel earlier and the group we were having lunch with that I appreciated that they understood terminology. I mean, something as basic as clear language, because clear language we think leads to clearer thinking, and clear thinking is required for effective action. So it starts as basic as knowing what a tactic is versus a method versus a strategy. And I think, you know, when people are sort of too fuzzy and imprecise with their language, I think it communicates something about maybe how effective they are. So we're kind of militant about terminology. And so I noticed that with these guys. And your other question was about gun control. And it's something I've been thinking about, but I haven't got a lot of thoughts on that. Maybe you've got something to share.
Well, I just what really boggles my mind is
can I give the mic to you?
Oops, my bag.
Well, I could probably do it loud.
It's for the recording.
Well, it just boggles my mind that the overwhelming public opinion, national public opinion, strongly favors, you know, all three of those major areas they're trying to get in Washington, the ban on assault rifles, limiting magazine clips as well as background checks, and ranges anywhere from like 68% to 90% on those three different issues. But it looks like the best they're going to do in the House and Senate is maybe pass a limited background check expansion. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, it's when the public opinion is so dominant, I mean, what kind of pressure can we put on the national legislatures to follow through and pass something mm-hmm. significant?
Mm-hmm. I hope people are working on that.
Steve Bannister, I teach in the economics department here. So if I understood you correctly, when I write my check on Monday to the IRS, I will not be funding you. How do you get your funding? And then I've got a follow-up question.
For a lot of years, we didn't. Well, it's for about 10 years, we had a principal donor. An individual, and then that individual has now set up his own organization. So a lot of this work was produced in years when our funding was quite adequate for probably about 10 years during the history of the institution. That was before my time. When I started, our funding had shrunk down to almost nothing. It was a budget of like a bit over $200,000. Something that sounds like a lot, but it actually isn't when you're paying a couple of salaries. So we continued basically receiving just private donations, so individual contributions and small family foundations and some foundational support. But foundations have historically been really non-responsive to funding this work because, you know, it is a bit controversial. I mean, it seems that way to a lot of people. This topic doesn't fit sort of established funding categories, and foundations are really strict about, you know, are you development or are you human rights or are you this? And we don't know what exactly we are. We're sort of a number of those things, and so I think historically it was very difficult to get the big foundation support. Maybe some of that is changing. So since you know a big New York Times piece that we had, and like the Wall Street Journal and some big media, we've gotten a lot more individual contributions. So people are buying books. I mean, the film has a huge role to play in this because suddenly our contributors were mostly, people in the U.S. Giving $50 and $100. And then suddenly, you know, the film brought this work to the attention of people in Australia and Brazil and Germany. And like people do, which is amazing, when they're moved to give, they make small but generous contributions, and when there's enough of them, they add up. So that's been sustaining us pretty well. In fact, we hired 2 new staff. We're still in that tiny space, but we've got 4 people now, as I mentioned. And then we sort of increased revenue from publication sales. So lots of people are buying books. It used to be that I used to fill the book orders myself like 6 or 7 years ago, and I used to send maybe 3 or 4 books a month. And there was last December, we were filling 100 orders a day or like 200 orders a day sometimes. So we're talking about, we were filling them out of our office. So huge exponential increase in publications revenue. And, you know, that adds up too. And lastly, sorry, I'm going on, but we've had a very important contribution and grant from the Norwegian government last week. So from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and it's the largest contribution that I've seen since my time here, you know, at the institution. So it's significant. It should be more. But, you know, we're definitely, you know, doing okay. It's certainly hanging in there.
Sounds pretty healthy. So my final question is, and you started to talk a bit about it, but why is it called the Albert Einstein Institution?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
good
it
question.
Has little to do with physics, apparently. But
right. Einstein had some very strong political views also. I've been told I should skip that whole discussion of Einstein's political views and get to the point, which is that Gene Sharp had correspondence with Albert Einstein in the 1950s. Gene Sharp was a conscientious objector to the Korean War, and Einstein they heard about each other, and he asked Einstein to write a foreword for his new book, which he had written at age 23 or something. It was a case studies about Gandhi. And he sent him the book, and he wrote a really, you know, Einstein wrote a really generous sort of a foreword for it. And after Einstein passed away, and then Jean was, you know, founding the Einstein Institution, you know, it's a brilliant name. It's obviously a very powerful brand and symbol, Albert Einstein. Okay. People are always impressed when I tell them I work there, even if they've never heard of the institution. Yeah, so it has to do in part with the support that Einstein showed for Jean during his conscious objector status, and also his views on Gandhi, which were that Gandhi is the most brilliant political thinker of our time. So not just, you know, Mahatma or a spiritual man or a kind man or a good man, but a strategist, and that this was important for the world in terms of dealing with some of the most serious political problems. And this is someone who is obviously very thoughtful, you know, Einstein, in terms of his thinking on World War II and on the bomb and on war and conflict and peace and stuff, so...
This concludes the Hinckley Forum for today. Please join me in thanking Jamel.
Thank you.